You're watching the Philip DeFranco Show. I hope you're having a fantastic Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning. I'll try not to ruin it too much, but we got a lot of news to talk about today, so let's just jump into it.
Starting with
an absolutely wild news. A Canadian DNA laboratory knowingly delivered paternity test results that regularly misidentified biological fathers. And according to the CBC News investigation that uncovered this scandal, this left a trail of shattered lives around the globe. And this affecting not just people in Canada, but across the US and in countries like Guatemala, the UK, and Australia. Right, and all of this has to do with a company by the name of ViaGuard Acumetrics. And specifically, we're talking about their prenatal tests. You know, the ones used to determine who the father is before the baby's actually born, which ViaGuard sold through online storefronts with names like Prenatal Paternities Inc. and Paternity Depot. But the main company is actually based in Toronto, and it's owned by a guy named Harvey Tenenbaum, who apparently is still up and running the lab, answering phones, and meeting with customers at 91 years of age, which by itself would be very impressive, except for the less admirable fact that apparently he gives zero fucks about how much he's messed up people's lives. Right, and that's because the investigation found that Tenenbaum was aware of the test's inaccuracy, as seen in hidden camera footage recorded by a CBC producer who went undercover as a customer.
Prenatal was never that accurate, and it's expensive. It's a couple $1,000 for a test.
Right.
That's the complication. That's why, because the test was not that accurate, that we're leery of that test now. It's pretty good, but pretty good is not good enough. But, and that has happened. Test a white guy and the baby came out black. Right, what the hell's going on here? You know what I mean?
Right.
And Tenenbaum actually goes on in that conversation to acknowledge the potential consequences of inaccurate test results, raising the question of what happens if a woman gets an abortion because she thinks the father is someone else. And with all that, I should note that these comments came after ViaGuard stopped offering the test sometime around 2021, with Tenenbaum saying in other instances that the decision only has to do with the test becoming more expensive, and insisting, despite what was said in that video, that the tests were never flawed. You know, to that point, I should note that prenatal paternity tests, if administered correctly, are actually very accurate. And the reason ViaGuard's tests were wrong so often seems to have a lot to do with how Tenenbaum was personally handling them, with former employees even telling CBC that he relied, quote, more on guesswork than science. For example, one person who worked at ViaGuard for 3 months said that Tenenbaum would have women provide information about their menstrual cycles and sexual histories, which notably is information that's useless for a DNA test, with him allegedly then going to say something like, it's definitely this one, it's this one, it's gotta be this one, referring to who he thought the biological father might be. Right? And one of the people this affected was an Atlanta man by the name of John Brennan, which no, not that one. Just same name. But this other John Brennan was wrongly identified as a baby's biological father.
As soon as I saw those test results, it was like a line in the sand. Immediately, right then and there, things just changed. My priorities changed. My perspective, my outlook on things changed. You know, everything I did was now geared towards building a future for this child.
And so Brennan, like, he made life decisions. He bought a house and a car to prepare for this kid, tattooed the kid's name on his arm. He spent $20,000 in a legal battle for custody of this child, with him then ultimately learning in a text message 8 months after the baby was born that he wasn't really the father. And really just showcasing how hard this hit him, he changed the tattoo from Travis to travesty, with him then reportedly spiraling into a self-destructive depression. Right, and really the whole point of telling that story is that whether it's negligence or incompetence, like, these tests being wrong have real consequences. Which is also why you might find it incredibly interesting to know that private commercial DNA laboratories, they don't actually need licenses to operate and sell services in Canada. So ViaGuard, they're still up and running today, though, as mentioned, you know, they no longer offer prenatal paternity tests. Though to my fellow Americans, don't get on a high horse. You know, that's one of our favorite things to do. Because in the US, most genetic tests are also not regulated, which, as the National Human Genome Research Institute pointed out, means that they can go to market without any independent analysis to verify the claims of the seller. And unfortunately, this is yet another example, and I say this as someone that detests unnecessary red tape, of what happens when you don't have checks in place. And then, is David Chang being the fucking worst right now? Is he a copyright bully? That is just one of the things being debated right now in this massive Chili Crunch scandal. Right, and for some background here, if you don't know, David Chang is a chef known for creating the Momofuku restaurant and food empire. Right, and one of Momofuku's popular products is Chili Crunch, which you can buy online and at places like Target. And as of last year, Momofuku acquired the rights to Chili Crunch, you know, with an E at the end, from a Denver company that had the trademark since 2015. And in March, Momofuku seemingly started expanding its reach over the name, filing for a trademark application for Chili Crunch with an I at the end, and they started sending out cease and desist letters to businesses selling the product. And according to The Guardian, which first reported this, letters were sent to companies using both spellings of the term, with many of those companies smaller than Momofuku, and they're pissed off that they're going after brands using the term Chili Crunch and arguing that it's a descriptive term for a general product. In fact, recipe developer James Park telling The Washington Post, this feels like the same thing as if they were going after the term hot sauce or ketchup or mustard. You also had The Guardian speaking to Michelle Tu, who founded the Malaysian food brand Homaya, which notably got hit with a cease and desist from Momofuku. They're explaining that her chili crunch is based on a family recipe, that their labels are not similar, and they said that getting hit with this letter was a punch in the gut. Right, and with this, she noted that David Chang is of Korean descent, so this comes from someone in the Asian culinary space, someone who has been very influential in adding, "If Kraft Heinz hit me up with a cease and desist, it would have been so distressing, but the fact that it was Momofuku makes me feel really, really sad." And the lawyer representing her brand also telling The Guardian, "The phrase that I would use to refer to Momofuku in this case is a trademark bully. This is a clear case of them picking on small businesses with a letter campaign, hoping they'll cave because of the financial pressure." According to the Washington Post, in their response to the letter, Homaya's lawyers wrote that, quote, "This isn't Momofuku's first attempt to register generic and descriptive terms for Asian foods," with them pointing to a previous sauce trademark application to argue there's a pattern to attempt to own generic Asian cultural products to anti-competitive effect. And so all of this starting a debate about who can even own cultural foods, right? Because so many of these businesses are owned by people with their own cultural ties to this condiment. With that, columnist Jen Harris writing for the LA Times, "I reject the notion that someone could exclusively own something so ingrained in my culture, a food I consider an intrinsic part of my identity. These trademarks will limit who can profit off of a food with a connection to entire cultures." Right? And there's a lot of things happening here. There's also a big debate about if this trademark even makes logical sense. With, for example, Duke University law professor Jennifer Jenkins telling the Post, "There is no secondary meaning connecting it to a single producer. When I see chili crunch on a jar, it tells me what's in the jar, not who produced it." Also adding here that getting the trademark undone might not be possible. Or the people who own companies selling chili crunch saying the term is not distinctive enough and that Momofuku had no influence on their product's name. People also pointing to Flyby Zhang, a brand that previously tried to trademark Sichuan Chili Crisp a few years ago but failed. And some people wondering how that was turned down, but chili crunch wasn't. In fact, the owner of that company has now become a vocal critic of Momofuku's actions. We also saw Simu Liu, who works with Mila, one of the brands targeted here, weighing in and tweeting at David Chang, "I hear you're bullying businesses over use of the term chili crunch. As chief content officer at Mila, I propose a blind taste test of both our chili crunch sauces. Winner keeps the name, loser, it'll be you, backs off. Game on." And then putting out another post encouraging people to support smaller businesses. But with all that said, for their part, Momofuku gave a statement to the LA Times saying that the brand is not trying to stifle innovation. Instead arguing, "When we created our product, we wanted a name we could own and intentionally picked Chili Crunch to further differentiate it from the broader Chili Crisp category." But with that said, there is a debate raging on, and depending on where you go on the internet, a lot of different opinions. Which is why with that, I gotta pass the question off to you. What are your thoughts here regarding David Chang and this trademark? And then, in absolutely horrifying news that luckily has a good ending, there was this little girl in Australia that was swept into the ocean by a massive wave, with them being caught on camera of her father jumping in after her. Right, and all of this happening over the weekend as record-breaking rain led to major flooding in eastern Australia. And just so you understand the scale of it, like, it's led to hundreds of rescues, evacuations, and even the government declaring a state of emergency. And in this specific situation, you had this toddler walking along the seawall with her dad in a city called North Wollongong, which is just south of Sydney. Right, and so the huge wave, it sweeps her off her feet into the ocean, then you see her dad jump over the railing. He ends up tumbling headfirst into the water, with then seeing these images showing the father holding on to his daughter for dear life as he tries to get through these rocks onto dry land, with also some of the eyewitnesses there reportedly doing their best to try and help, and then a helicopter and emergency services arriving on the scene. You know, we saw one of those rescuers speaking to 7 News Australia and saying,
"So what we saw was community spirit. Everyone just jumped in and done what they had to do."
Right, but the situation doesn't just have people like clapping and going, "Great job, everyone," because you also have a lot of people going, "What the hell was this dad thinking in the first place? Right, why was his daughter out there?" And to that, you had a reporter for 7 News saying,
"The dad is devastated. He feels incredibly guilty."
And reportedly, the mom of this toddler took to a community Facebook group to say, "I can't excuse my husband's actions. His naivete on the ocean put our daughter at risk," and saying he is beyond remorseful, also thanking the rescuers, but also saying, "I'm sorry my husband put you in that position." Which is why, yeah, you have a lot of people kind of torn on the dad, saying, you know, he definitely messed up big time, but also he notably did not hesitate to put his life on the line to save his kid. Which is why, you know, with all that said, I gotta pass the question off to you. Where do you land on this? What are you thinking and why? I'd love to hear from you. And then, y'all, Drake, Beyonce, Ariana Grande, Taylor Swift, they're getting banned. Because in interesting international news, Chechnya has a problem with popular music right now. Though not in the way you might be thinking, where you're like, oh, is it like a lyrics thing? No, instead, they're banning a ton of music because they're either saying it is too fast or too slow. Instead, music in Chechnya will need to be in this Goldilocks just right spot, which according to Chechnya's culture minister is 80 to 116 beats per minute. With a release there saying that all musical, vocal, and choreographic works must fit into that tempo range, and adding that this is an effort to ensure that music conforms, quote, with the Chechen mentality, with lots of news outlets noting that this is an effort to limit Western influence in the area, which is notably a conservative Muslim-majority Russian republic. And the Moscow Times reporting that the Chechen leader said that, quote, borrowing musical culture from other peoples is inadmissible. And so also with this, local artists there have been ordered to rewrite their music by June 1st, otherwise they're not going to be allowed to perform it. Though with that, it's not exactly clear how they're going to enforce this, right, how far the reach is. But notably, this would block a lot of music. In fact, Politico did a deep dive into what popular songs would actually be okay here, and we got bad news for Swifties. Cruel Summer, Bad Blood, and Shake It Off, All Out for Being Too Fast, Lovers Out for Being Too Slow. You're also going to have to say goodbye or thank you next to Ariana Grande's new hits, Yes And. Also, in good news for fans of Beyonce's Country Moment, Texas Hold'em fits perfectly right in that range. There were anthems like Run the World and Single Ladies getting banned. And for the Drake fans out there, God's Plan's Too Slow and Hotline Bling is Too Fast. But also, something that's just kind of funny with this, if they were actually to apply this to everything, notably the Russian national anthem is 76 beats per minute, which would make it too slow. Though I have a feeling they're gonna let that one slide. And then, it is so hard to give up on things that we enjoy, even when they're not good for us. But if you look at it like it's not giving it up, but also switching it up, I think that's a game changer. And thanks to the sponsor of today's show, Fume, they're offering up a switch to help take the bad out of bad habits. Right? Fume's an innovative, award-winning flavored air device that takes your habit and simply makes it better, healthier, and more enjoyable. They offer different flavors from orange vanilla, crisp mint, which I found quite refreshing, and sparkling grapefruit. And really though, I didn't know what to expect, but I was really surprised at how flavorful it was. And the fidgeter in me loves the movable parts and the magnets. You know, it's balanced just right. It keeps your fingers busy, which helps with anxieties that come with these types of changes. You can even adjust the airflow to your liking. I also like the magnetic stand that they have for your fumes, so there's no losing it around the house. And really, that's it. You're just breathing in naturally flavored air through an award-winning device. No artificial flavors, nasty chemicals, or batteries involved, just flavored air. So start the year off with the good habit by going to tryfum.com/DeFranco and use code DeFranco to save 10% off when you get the Journey Pack today. And then Jon Stewart just went in on the Biden administration and it is making waves. Right, and specifically, last night on The Daily Show, he went in on how Biden has responded to the war in Gaza, which has now officially been raging for 6 months. Now with this, a lot of people are saying, you know, this is nothing new, but specifically, it's the way that he presents it that's so powerful, right? Because he really compares the contradictions in how the administration has treated Israel's war with Gaza to Russia's war with Ukraine. And that despite America's preaching about universal values of morality. Starting off with these clips of remarks Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken made at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
In the great battle for freedom, between a rules-based order and one governed by brute force, in this battle, we need to be clear-eyed.
Weaponizing food, using it as a tool, as a weapon in its war against Ukraine, it's unconscionable. Should not happen.
With Stewart then comparing that to the state of play in Gaza.
Speaking of which, there is a literal famine in Gaza caused by the war. I assume America will also consider this unconscionable.
Absolutely, we're concerned about that. No question about it.
Well, you can't spell unconscionable without concern. Or at least part of it, the CON part.
With Stewart then going on to talk about the huge differences in how America has supported press freedoms in Ukraine and Gaza, and specifically with that, pointing to this clip of the White House press secretary last year.
We also condemn the Russian government's continued targeting and repression of journalists.
You hear that, Russia? We condemn, in no uncertain terms, any repression of a free press.
Right, and you have Stewart arguing that you'd hope to see the same response to Gaza, especially because more journalists have been killed in that half-year-long war than anywhere else in the world. And this is he also pointed to Israel's new law that says that they can ban any media outlet that they think is a threat, which, you know, is something that we talked about last week, and it's widely seen as an effort to shut down Al Jazeera. Notably, the press secretary's response was markedly different.
So as it relates to Al Jazeera, specifically, we've seen the reports. If it is true, a move like this is concerning.
We're concerned again. How about if it's true, we condemn it?
Right, and this is where Stewart really starts to lean in.
Perhaps these are just peripheral issues. What about the bedrock rule of international law? No taking land by force. When Russia does it, we're pretty clear.
The entire world has a stake in making sure that no nation, no aggressor, is allowed to take a neighbor's territory by force. The American people will never waver in our commitment to those values.
Ish.
Right in here, Stuart notes that some people say Israel's war is different than Russia's because Israel is responding to the October 7th attack by Hamas in a hostage crisis. But just a few weeks ago, on March 22nd, Israel announced that it was seizing 2,000 acres of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, which notably is the largest single Israeli appropriation in more than three decades. And they did that the same day that Secretary Blinken was in Israel for peace talks, with Stuart arguing that surely that would constitute taking territory by force.
And that's not even Gaza, that's the West Bank. So you can't say it has anything to do with defending yourself against Hamas. Let's see if America upholds its rule against taking land.
I haven't seen the specifics of this, but anyone taking steps that makes things more difficult, more challenging this time, is something that we have a problem with.
You don't know about it. They did it the day you visited. Why do we tiptoe around on eggshells? They slap America in the face, and our response is, well, if anyone slapped us in the face, it'd be concerning, that's for sure. The verbal gymnastics that the American government must undertake so as not to offend the delicate sensibilities of a country we provide most of the weapons for is, yeah! Every time America tells the world that there's something we won't allow, Israel seems to say, challenge accepted. Are they willfully trying to provoke us?
With Stuart then going on to reiterate the current death toll in Gaza of 30,000 people, including 13,000 children, and noting that the U.S. response has been a push for Israel to act with precision in their targeting. Though, of course, this is such precision targeting has resulted in aid workers being killed from World Central Kitchen. And, of course, that just being one small example. With Stuart here then also going on to play almost a dozen clips of White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby calling on Israel to act with precision, to be careful, cautious, deliberate, all the synonyms. And he ends with this one.
A special burden. To be mindful.
To be mindful? What is this, hot yoga? We just, you know, we've seen the bombing and we are urging Netanyahu to be present. What the are we doing here? The subtext of all this is America knows this is wrong. But it apparently doesn't seem to have the courage to say it in a straightforward manner. America and Israel both know that you cannot bomb your way into safety. Real friends take the f***ing keys because friends don't let friends bomb that much.
And then, as I'm recording this, this Missouri man, Brian Dorsey, is set to be put to death in just a few hours after the governor and state Supreme Court turned down any last-minute clemency requests and appeals. And this notably as Dorsey has a lot of supporters on his side, and I'm talking about like more than just family and friends. This including Republican state lawmakers, former justices of Missouri Supreme Court, and even 70 correctional officers tasked with keeping him behind bars, begging the governor to spare his life. Now, to be clear, I am not saying that Dorsey should be free or that his crime wasn't heinous. Even he admits that. And so specifically, he is asking for life behind bars. Now, that said, it is obviously going to be hard for you to form an opinion without knowing the underlying crime, which, to give you the quick version, is that back in the early 2000s, he was in some drug debt. His cousin Sarah Bonnie and her husband Benjamin, they offered to help him out. Well, at their house and after partying with them, he snuck into the room with a shotgun and he killed them both, with him then stealing some stuff and leaving their young daughter behind. He was also originally accused of raping Sarah's body, but was never charged with that crime, with Dorsey then turning himself in 3 days later and admitted to everything after consulting with public defenders, with him having said since then that that entire experience was during a dark period of addiction and that he was suffering from, quote, drug-induced psychosis and alcohol-induced blackout, which legally speaking is an important distinction because reportedly if he had used that defense, it could have helped him prevent a first-degree murder charge and the death penalty. However, he didn't use that defense, which we'll talk about in a second. And that's because the main thing that his various clemency requests have focused on was his rehabilitation, with one of the 70 correctional officers who supported his request writing, "The Brian I have known for years could not hurt anyone. The Brian I know does not deserve to be executed." And another adding, "I do not hesitate to say that executing Brian Dorsey would be a pointless cruelty." Right, and this is Dorsey's report. Been a barber behind bars and is universally considered a model prisoner, especially because as a barber, he's had access to tools where he could actually harm people, but he's been trusted enough to cut the hair and beards of prisoners, officers, and even the warden. And so one of the angles they really went on with this was that execution should be reserved for people who are irredeemable, right, and not those who have a good track record behind bars. With one officer even writing, "If Brian Dorsey has not been rehabilitated, then the word ceases to have any meaning at all." Now, even five jurors who helped decide his fate saying he should be granted clemency. Now, with that said, whether capital punishment should take into consideration information what someone has done since getting into prison or not, you know, I'll leave that to you in the comments. But notably, he and his new legal team, they're not just relying on that argument. Instead, saying they have concerns about how he was represented in his case, and claiming that his old team failed him miserably by not doing any basic legal work in order to just move on from the case. And that, quote, if they had, they would have known what we know now, which was Brian had lifelong chronic depression and that he had turned to self-medicating with alcohol and crack cocaine at this point because other treatments had failed. Also adding he had a history of experiencing psychosis when withdrawing from crack, experienced paranoid and persecutory delusions and hallucinations, and saying this is a defense to capital murder. If they had done the basic interviewing of their client and investigation, they would have known they had a defense. And they would have used that to either negotiate a plea deal with a benefit of a life sentence, or they would have gone to trial because they had a defense. And instead, we saw his legal team push for him to admit guilt without any kind of plea deal in place, leaving him completely at the mercy of the judge and prosecution. Right? And in cases like that, they're likely going to throw the book at you. So that's not to say that plea deals are foolproof. You know, judges technically have the power to ignore them, which leaves a defendant in the awkward position of admitting guilt and now facing whatever punishment the judge wants. So situations like that are generally seen as rare, and judges understand that undermining plea deals like that is expensive for the system, and it would undermine any trust in doing that. And so, you know, with this, it's argued that, you know, that alone is a really bad look for his original legal team. Now, it's also being alleged that they did such a shit job because of a financial conflict of interest, because they were given a flat $12,000 for the case. And if you do the math for how many hours they'd have to work for a potential capital murder case and the appeals that are required afterwards, like, it comes out to well below minimum wage. Though, and I want to stress this, it's not like everyone's been on board with this clemency plea. Like, even his family is split on the issue, with Bonnie's family writing in a statement that Dorsey was a close family member who was given a safe haven to get him out of a bad situation and turn this helping hand into the ultimate betrayal of a loved one. With the man going on to detail how he stole not only the lives of this little girl's parents, but also stole first day of school, school parties, school dances, first date, sweet 16, first boyfriend, and high school graduation, and saying all of this was taken from her by a family member that proclaimed to love her. And as of recording, the authorities haven't been persuaded by his team's arguments of bad representation, his rehabilitation, or that he shouldn't be eligible for the death penalty because he was suffering from an alleged drug-induced psychosis. But for them, he's still just a man who brutally and coldly murdered a couple trying to help him for some money. So far, the most it seems like his legal team has been able to do for him is make him a little more comfortable at the end, because it turns out that Dorsey is diabetic and has other conditions that make finding veins hard. And so normally in those situations, executioners cut open your arms or legs to find a vein, they remove the tissue near it, and then insert the needles. And that doesn't have to be done with any pain relief, with his team arguing that's just extreme pain and it's cruel. And so an agreement was made to have pain relief ready if needed. So I guess where I'll leave this is, you know, what are your thoughts in general regarding capital punishment? But then also, in addition to that general answer, when you have a specific situation like this one, whether it be about representation, the alleged drug psychosis, or even the idea of rehabilitation, and obviously we're talking about an extreme crime here, where do you land?
And then,
you know, I used to struggle with turning my brain off after a stressful day, and I found myself just tossing and turning, trying to fall asleep, or I just wake up multiple times throughout the night. And if that sounds familiar to your experience, or maybe even someone you know, you gotta check out our fantastic partner, the PDS, Beam. Because Beam's dream, it's made with the highest quality sleep-promoting ingredients. It helps me unwind from a busy day and get the deep sleep that my body needs. And just as important, maybe even more important, it doesn't make me feel groggy come the morning. Instead, I wake up feeling refreshed. And Beam's dream is clinically shown to help you sleep better. Plus, there's no added sugar and it's only 15 calories. So just head over to shopbeam.com/DeFranco and use code DeFranco, or scan the QR code to get up to 35% off. And look into subscription perks like 20% off each month, a free frother with your first order, cancel or pause at any time, swap to a new flavor when you like. There's so many delicious ones to choose from, and free shipping. Just remember, that's shopbeam.com/DeFranco and use code DeFranco.
And then
there's this debate going right now, and it centers around the question of, is indoor farming just another thing that claims to be green but is actually horrible for the environment? It makes sense that there's a debate because the industry is continuing to grow at an exponential rate. And it's also a super important question because the concerns here aren't your normal run-of-the-mill greenwashing allegations. But the situation's a whole lot stickier because greenhouse farming is without a doubt going to be an essential solution for adapting our food system to the ever-growing threats of global warming. You know, we're already seeing how climate change has exacerbated existing environmental problems and directly impacts our food and agricultural production. Right? Intensifying climate conditions have brought more extreme droughts, floods, and pest infestations. It's also sped up soil degradation, groundwater depletion. It's made growing conditions impossible or more limited in some areas. And the list of the problems, they go on and on. You know, as long as the climate crisis continues to get worse, these problems will only grow and grow. But with indoor farming, you don't have to deal with any of that because the environment can be completely controlled to create ideal growing conditions. Right? Traditional outdoor farming is dictated by region and season. In many places, you can only grow certain crops during certain times of the year. And that's then even more limited by adverse weather conditions driven by climate change, which can at times shorten growing seasons or completely wipe whole crops out, all of which cause food shortages and insecurity. But indoor agriculture protects produce from extreme weather conditions, meaning that you can grow any crop anywhere at any time. You grow a fucking tomato in Alaska in the dead of winter. And because greenhouse farming's done year-round, it produces higher yields than outdoor methods and often using less land. Right, one popular version of this is vertical farming, where you have plants that are just stacked on top of each other from floor to ceiling. And according to Eden Green Technology, a vertical greenhouse company based in Texas, the difference in yield between indoor and outdoor operations is very significant. But the company is saying they found that vertical farming can produce as much as 50 to 100 times more per square foot, while non-vertical greenhouse agriculture increase yields 10 to 12 times over traditional practices. And so as a result, indoor farming has been touted by supporters as an important tool to address food shortages and boost food security, which of course are problems that already exist and will only get worse as one, the population continues to grow, and two, that the climate crisis continues. Right? And in addition to just producing more food in general, indoor farms can be set up anywhere and can create more access to food in areas that lack traditional farming methods, right? Like regions with harsh environments, places that don't have arable land, or densely populated urban centers. And all that also has other positive environmental impacts, right? Because produce can be grown closer to consumers, it reduces the need for food to be transported hundreds or even thousands of miles, cutting down transit-related carbon emissions. And on the note of helping the environment, indoor practices also use way less water, with research backing up the industry claim that greenhouse agriculture uses 1/10 of the water that traditional farms use. And then beyond that, because crops grown inside are protected from pests, these facilities often don't need to use pesticides or chemical fertilizers, which not only reduces environmental impacts, but it's great for human safety as well. And so at this point, you might be thinking, wow, Phil, are you exhausted from all that glazing? All of this sounds so great. Why would this in any way be bad for the environment? To which I would say, you've watched the Philip DeFranco show for how long? You think we get to have nice things, no problem? Well, it's your classic capitalist trade-off. While indoor farming can produce certain environmental benefits, it also hurts the planet in other ways because it requires so much damn energy. And most of that energy right now, it comes from, you guessed it, fossil fuels. Recreating perfect growing conditions year-round, it requires extensive heating and cooling controls. With one expert telling the Washington Post, it's a lot of the same technologies you see in a building for human comfort, but being put to use for plants. For example, indoor farms in colder areas, they need to heat their greenhouses, and they usually do that with the cheapest option, natural gas or propane. And those vertical farms that produce such high yields, they typically use even more electricity than other greenhouses. And that because they normally use artificial lights to grow plants instead of the sun, while also powering energy-intensive cooling and dehumidifier systems. And so the big question here is, do these practices hurt the environment more than they help it? Which I will say right at the top, very notably, the amount of energy used, it ranges widely based on the size of these facilities and what they grow. And this is also many companies in the space do not disclose their energy use. And that probably because most states don't require them to. So actually getting an accurate answer to that question is tricky. And the research on the whole matter has been contradictory. One study of 12 indoor operations found that 5 of them used as much energy per square foot as a whole hospital. And then one vertical farm even used as much as a data center. Meanwhile, other studies also looked at facilities in the US and Northern Europe that use fossil fuels and found that on average, production of 1 pound of tomatoes resulted in 3 to 3.5 pounds of carbon being released into the atmosphere. Or to put it another way, that is nearly 6 times the carbon footprint of tomatoes grown outside, even after accounting for emissions from temperature-controlled trucks that have to transport the vegetables thousands of miles. But then, at the same time, a paper that summarized research on the emissions of lettuce growers found that their carbon pollution was lower than traditional farms because they were closer to their buyers and didn't have to ship their products as far. But also, one of the biggest things is while this incredibly important debate, this plays out, the whole industry is still moving forward full speed. Right? Indoor farming has seen a ton of growth in the last few years, with investors throwing money at these efforts. And according to the federal government agriculture census from February, land use for crop greenhouses increased by more than 20 million square feet from 2017 to 2022, which is a major jump of 18%. And more places are seeing these vegetables on their grocery store shelves. In fact, according to the Post, around 20% of the leafy greens for sale in New England come from controlled environment agriculture facilities. Hell, even some of the biggest retailers in America are getting involved, with Kroger recently announcing that it was expanding the availability of its vertically grown produce. And in 2022, Walmart joined a $400 million round of investment aimed at stocking its stores with crops from the California-based vertical farming outfit Plenty Unlimited. And all this is an increasing number of state governments have been getting involved as well, with, for example, Virginia seeing a huge boom, with the industry there growing nearly 25% in 5 years. And it's expected to grow more, with Plenty announcing that it will build the world's biggest indoor agriculture site outside Richmond. Also, Pennsylvania is another big one, with Agriculture Secretary Russell Redding telling the Post that his state has created a concierge service to help the permitting process for indoor farms. And some of the state schools are even working on tools to speed up automation in those facilities while others are training workers. But with that, even Redding admitted that these projects will have a negative environmental impact, saying these facilities are energy intensive, but adding Pennsylvania is the second largest net energy supplier to the nation, and we think that's a differentiator for us. Now, all that said, some indoor agriculture companies have tried to make their facilities more environmentally friendly. For example, Eden Green has cut energy use from lights by using a hybrid model that also relies on natural sunlight. It also started using a programmed vent to control heat and humidity, with the company's CEO telling the Post that his two farms use about a quarter of the electricity vertical farms usually use for leafy greens. Also, Little Leaf Farms, right, the major producer of indoor-grown packaged greens in New England, they've been buying renewable energy certificates to offset its fossil fuel use. And the company also saying it's planning to build a big solar panel array and hopes to switch to geothermal energy, which the Netherlands is already doing. And, you know, to that point, a civil engineer who tracks energy use by indoor farms told the Post that many American outfits could cut their energy use by as much as half. And they're noting that Dutch greenhouse technology has already shown this is possible. But of course, this is in the United States. Oil is king. And the insanely powerful fossil fuel industry has unlimited amounts of money and lobbying power. And so right now, what we've seen is that there really isn't much pressure for these companies to do things differently. And this is currently renewable energy is more expensive than fossil fuels here. And so as long as fossil fuels remain the cheapest option and there are no government incentives to attract corporate interest to renewable resources, like, it's hard to imagine that things are going to change in a substantial way. And this is going to be damn sure the oil industry is going to do everything to fight any kind of shift to renewables. You know, money moves, but money also blocks. But with now all that said, I got to pass the question off to you. What are your thoughts with all this?
And then
finally today we have yesterday. Today where we dive into the comments on yesterday's show and see what y'all had to say. And you know, one of the things I asked yesterday was, what was your solar eclipse experience? And I will never accuse some of you of not being oversharers. With Usagi saying, I watched the eclipse from my toilet. I'd lost track of time while having a bout of IBS and then noticed it was getting dark. Thankfully, I have a skylight and was able to watch the reflection on the wall. It was a nice mix of a lovely natural sight while also having a miserable experience of my own. With Anthony responding, hashtag shits for eclipse. That's it. I think I'm done with the show. I think we peaked. We also had Foxy saying, I almost forgot the eclipse was happening. Thank God Sonic was giving free glasses out with her eclipse drink. Which I will say, I always forget Sonic is a thing. Like, it used to be one of my favorite ways to get the sugar shakes, but then there's just not a lot. There's not many, I think, around me. Also, my favorite place to go for on-the-go mozzarella sticks, which sounds like it shouldn't be a thing, and probably it shouldn't be, but when they're just under lava hot, hits so great. Do they still have people skate up to the car? Why am I asking a person that's not here things that I could Google? We also had a porn bot that stole someone else's comment saying, the illusion of nighttime and the temperature drop during the eclipse was surreal to experience in real time. It really felt like something out of a movie. You also had Juggler saying they witnessed the eclipse in Oklahoma. They called it surreal. Which I gotta say, I love seeing all the people that just had a great experience. I asked my oldest son, Trey, yesterday how it was, right? They got time outside to look at it. He gave it a 4 out of 10. Though in the moon and sun's defense, we were not in the path of totality here. Also, I gotta take a second to give a shout out to Trey and Carter for their individual, like, last grade levels, they got student of the month. So I gotta give them props, even though secretly it's just me kind of bragging for a second that I don't completely suck as a parent. Though also with this, I have to heavily credit the kids' teachers and the school staff. Like, it's good teachers and schools that are able to support them. Like, they make such a difference. And then finally, I gotta say, I'm happy that a lot of people also felt the same way about Heroes. Although I wonder if any actors or writers from that show, they feel maybe like they got bailed out by the writer's strike. Like, you know how with in football, so many of us go like, what the hell is Pete Carroll thinking throwing on the 1 yard line in the Super Bowl with the game on the line? You got fucking Marshawn Lynch, who's just unstoppable that year. But, you know, and the truth is, we don't know how it would have played out. I have 99% of an idea of how it would have played out there, but we'll never know. Kind of like we'll never know if that show is already doomed to fail. But that's also because I think when it comes to superheroes, stories, and shows, it often seems like the best of stories are origin stories. It's why back in the day, if you're a SourceFed fan, maybe you're one of the 7 people that saw this video. I told M. Night Shyamalan that, like, Unbreakable is one of my favorite movies, and I think it's in part because I love origin movies. I'm someone that doesn't want a sequel. And then years later, Glass came out, and I was like, yep, I was right. But anyway, I'm just yapping now, so I'm gonna give you back your day. That's where today's show ends. Thank you so much for being a part of another one. And if you're somehow not sick of my face and voice yet, good news for you. My name's Philip DeFranco. You've just been filled in. I love yo faces, and I'll see you right back here tomorrow. You on my mind a lot. Don't need no time watch. I don't know how I got you in my pocket spot. Yeah, that's babe, need you every day. You light my oxygen.